Welcome to the 34th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to New York City for a State of the Science Summit on breast cancer. During the meeting, faculty from the Icahn School of Medicine of Mount Sinai Health System, as well as Columbia University Medical Center, discussed the latest updates in the rapidly evolving paradigms of triple-negative breast cancer, HER2-positive breast cancer, hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative disease, and more. First, we sat down with Melissa K. Accardino, MD, MS, who spoke with us about the importance of disease monitoring in metastatic breast cancer. As there are currently no prospective data to inform how to appropriately do this, clinicians are monitoring their patients with a combination of imaging with or without tumor markers. In our interview, Accardino, an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center, shared insight on methods to improve this important part of breast cancer management.
Well, I am talking about how we monitor patients with metastatic breast cancer. And there's really not a lot of data at all for how to do this. And there certainly is no prospective data at the moment. So what we know is that patients are frequently monitored with a combination of imaging plus or minus tumor markers, and they're often done at frequencies that vary from physician to physician. So what we also know is that disease monitoring can be very stressful on patients, and there could be a lot of anxiety related to it because patients are very nervous about progression. There's also a term that Time Magazine coined called scanxiety, where patients just are so anxious about having scans, they're uncomfortable, they're often an all-day affair. Sometimes they require IV placement or contrast, which is never comfortable. And then there's always the delay to have the results. So it's a very stressful time for patients. And there's also data that shows finding progression as soon as it's there is not associated with better outcomes. So we can often stress patients out for all these reasons, and maybe we're not doing them any good anyway. So we actually have a study that we just launched through SWOG, which is a randomized study which randomizes patients who have elevated tumor marker levels to either be monitored with tumor markers alone until those markers elevate and then they get a scan, or to have usual care, which is scans at least every 3 months, which is about the standard, plus or minus tumor markers. And the outcome is overall survival, but we're also looking at cost of care and patient-reported anxiety and quality of life, because we think we probably can minimize what we're doing to these patients and improve quality of life and cost of care without impacting survival.
Next, we spoke with Stephen C. Malamud, MD, who broke down the pivotal data presented at the 2018 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. At the summit, Malamud highlighted new standards of care, de-escalation strategies, and precision medicine approaches across breast cancer histologies. One study that garnered a lot of attention was the Phase 3 CATHERINE trial, which demonstrated a new standard of care in the adjuvant setting of high-risk HER2-positive breast cancer. In the study, adotrastuzumab emtansine, known as T-DM1, was shown to reduce the risk of disease recurrence or death by 50% compared with trastuzumab in patients who had residual disease following neoadjuvant therapy. Malamud, an associate professor at the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai Health System, discussed key takeaways from this study, the potential for PD-L1 inhibition in TNBC, and de-escalation strategies for patients with HER2-positive disease.
I think the theme for San Antonio this way, I think there were probably two themes. One being tweaking what we already know about precision medicine to try and pick those patients out who not only have a potentially targetable treatment, but to find out who amongst those targets will actually respond. One of the other trials that was especially interesting was the one where we saw the clinical utility of atezolizumab in triple negative breast cancer, where we had positive data from its first presentation, but now we see in the triple negative subset the real benefit is to be derived in those patients who have demonstrable evidence of PD-L1 activity on the infiltrating lymphocytes, not so common to see it on the tumor cells themselves, but to show infiltrating lymphocytes with the PD-L1 marker was an exceptional way of picking out those patients who would respond to the drug of choice here, where you would avoid giving it to patients who would not necessarily benefit from it, and therefore not be subject to the potential risks of the drug or the economic costs of the drug. So again, fine-tuning again those patients who we knew there was a chance for response, but to pick out those who were most likely to change. Next was, again fine-tuning, and not only so fine-tuning precision medicine, but adjusting or de-escalation of therapy in patients who don't need so much treatment. And there were essentially two major trials that looked to that. One was another HER2-based, Herceptin-based program looking at the updates of the FAIR trial, which was 6 months of Herceptin versus the standard paradigm of 12 months of Herceptin. This was a trial randomized mostly in Europe, and they had set the confidence intervals at a certain point and could not prove non-inferiority. So actually, I guess we've taught from childhood not to talk about double negatives, but this was not non-inferior, which in real English means it was inferior. But this was, again, in contradistinction to a trial presented not that long ago with the Persephone trial, where there was a difference, where there was not inferior. So again, there's a lot of discussion going on, and some of the slides that I'm going to show here today, although it was the confidence intervals that crossed the border of acceptability, so the clinician himself is going to need to look at those and see how that weighs into the risks, benefits, and advantages of continuing beyond the 6 months. One other trial that looked to, again, de-escalating and providing less toxicity was one also coming out of a multi-center Italian group that looked at lower dose tamoxifen. We haven't done pharmacological studies in tamoxifen since it probably entered the oncological arena back in the 1970s, and the 10-20 milligram dose has been, I hate to use the word standard, but dogma for all that time. And this was now a trial looking to get women through a program with less toxicity with equal efficacy. And in that trial, looking at a 5 milligram dose, which is not even available in the United States, there are 10 milligrams, but not 5 milligrams, the outcomes were very similar with compliance equal to the placebo, with a lower risk of endometrial cancer. So again, weighing those risks and benefits, if you have a woman who is really incapacitated with hot flashes or discomfort with the 20 milligram dose, there is now comfort to be derived that you can probably accomplish the same result with a lower dose, whether or not that's going to be 10 milligrams or 5 milligrams, but that confidence is there that you don't walk away thinking that you may be undertreating that woman.
With the goal of avoiding overtreatment of patients with early stage hormone receptor positive breast cancer, de-escalation of adjuvant therapy continues to be an active area of investigation. Although we have reached an era with a promising cure rate, says Paula Klein, MD, treatment of patients should be based on disease biology rather than tumor size. While the available therapies are effective, avoiding their toxicities, if possible, is equally important. Klein, an associate professor at the Icahn School of Medicine in the Mount Sinai Health System, discussed the basis for deciding if patients with HR-positive breast cancer need extended adjuvant therapy or if they could benefit from de-escalation strategies.
So the whole field is trying to de-escalate. You know, we've reached a cure rate that is terrific, but it came with piling on lots of treatment to many, many patients. And we know that we're over-treating a good number of patients. And of course, you know, the goal is to find those patients who don't benefit and only get additional toxicity from whatever treatment it is, whether it's targeted treatments, antibodies, anti-estrogens, etc. So the stage has been set to continue adjuvant therapy beyond the 5 years, and there are some hallmark trials that certainly pave the way. But once again, with a full knowledge that we're over-treating. And there have been some studies looking at less of an extension that seem to be just as good. So the goal, of course, is to find the high-risk patient that's bound to recur despite the 5 years of endocrine therapy, and only treat those. Holy grail. We're not there. So it's still a crapshoot, as patients say.
For many years, the treatment landscape for metastatic TNBC remained stagnant, with very few options available to patients. But 2018 was a year of great advancement in this space, says Meghna Trivedi, MD. PARP inhibitors such as talazoparib, checkpoint inhibitors like atezolizumab, and antibody drug conjugates like sacituzumab govitecan have all made headway in the treatment of these patients. Most recently, in March 2019, the FDA granted an accelerated approval to the combination of atezolizumab and nab-paclitaxel for patients with locally advanced or metastatic PD-L1 positive TNBC. The approval was based on exciting data from the IMPASSION 130 study. In our interview, Trivedi, an associate professor of medicine at Columbia University Medical Center, said that even though the future looks bright, there are still challenges that need to be addressed in this space.
I think that, you know, again, because of the aggressive nature and the poor prognosis that's associated with triple negative breast cancer, you know, we still have a lot of work ahead of us. And I'm excited and hopeful for some of these new novel therapies that we have. And I think awaiting the results of some of these larger phase three trials and looking at, final results for overall survival and progression-free survival are going to really help us figure out what other how we can best utilize these therapies in this population, whether it be in combination or even the setting in which we can use it. So looking at it, maybe not, if these drugs can demonstrate benefit in the metastatic setting, how can we use these early on in the treatment course for these patients, again, who have a very aggressive tumor, and if they become metastatic and ultimately have a poor prognosis.
In locally advanced HER2-positive breast cancer, HER2-targeted agents like neratinib and pertuzumab have dramatically shifted practice both in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant treatment settings. Neratinib was approved by the FDA in July 2017 for the extended adjuvant treatment of patients with early-stage HER2-positive disease following postoperative trastuzumab. However, neratinib is not without its toxicity concerns. At the summit, Teresa Hsiao, MD, an assistant professor of hematology oncology in the Mount Sinai Health System, highlighted the promise of neratinib and shared words of advice on managing the TKI's toxicity.
Neratinib is actually a new molecule. It's a small tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It's an irreversible tyrosine inhibitor of HER1, HER3, and HER4. The study that I'm going to talk about is the XNS trial, where it's looking at neratinib in the extended adjuvant therapy setting where a patient had trastuzumab and they started this drug within 1 year of completing trastuzumab. And the study showed that the addition neratinib for another year has improvement in invasive disease-free survival as well. Mostly it's seeing patient with ER-positive and also node-positive disease, so patient at higher risk and also ER-positive. So the question, sort of the thing, the main concern from the study was there were about 40% of patients on the study with grade 3 diarrhea. So it's quite sort of high number, and a lot of patients discontinued the therapy very early on. So there was a lot of concern from the physicians as well as patient how, applicable this is if there's so much diarrhea. In addition, we didn't have the pertuzumab data out, and it's unclear whether the addition of pertuzumab in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting, whether that has any impact on neratinib use, and whether neratinib is helpful if patient had pertuzumab as well, because the XNS study did not have any patient who received pertuzumab. So that was sort of the concern initially with the drug being used. So subsequent to the study, they actually did another study called the control trial, which I'm also going to talk about tonight, where there's additional sort of diarrhea prophylaxis. So in the study, the XNS study, there was no diarrhea prophylaxis. Patients were just taking Imodium as needed. In this study, they were looking at three ways of sort of a prophylactic regimen to see whether the diarrhea will improve. And what they also see is the diarrhea mostly happened in the first 1 to 2 cycles. So the addition of a prophylactic regimen for diarrhea could be helpful. So in the study, they look at three regimen. One is with the Imodium alone. The other is Imodium plus budesonide. The last one is Imodium with this other drug, cholestipol. And what they find is if the patients had prophylaxis with Imodium and cholestipol, at least for the first cycle, there is a significant decrease in diarrhea, especially grade 3 to 4. So instead of 40%, what we see in the study, is down to 10%. And there is also significantly less discontinuation rate. So as a result, I think this seems to be more applicable, you know, if the patients are, you know, willing to give neratinib a try, that within the first cycle, we want to initiate Imodium plus cholestipol as anti-diarrheal prophylactic regimen. And once you get through the initial cycle, people seem to tolerate the drug much better. And then the rate of diarrhea also subsides significantly.
In the most common subset of breast cancer, HR-positive, HER2-negative disease, the three FDA-approved CDK4/6 inhibitors have extended progression-free and overall survival. Moreover, a precision medicine approach has emerged in this landscape with the introduction of the PI3 kinase inhibitor, alpelisib. The SOLAR-1 trial, which was initially presented at the 2018 ESMO Congress with updated results announced at the 2018 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, showed a PFS benefit with the combination of alpelisib and fulvestrant in patients who harbored PI3CA mutations. Kevin Kalinske, MD, MS, and assistant professor of medicine at the Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center and Columbia University Medical Center, discussed the data with alpelisib as well as the next steps with this research.
We talked about the results of the SOLAR-1 trial. So SOLAR-1 looked at patients who had metastatic hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer who previously received an aromatase inhibitor. And these patients all had PI3K mutations seen in about a third to 40% or so of breast cancers that are hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative. And the study looked at giving fulvestrant plus or minus BYL, which is a PI3K alpha specific inhibitor. And we saw that there was an improvement in progression-free survival if they received the combination compared to just getting fulvestrant plus placebo. There had been prior PI3K inhibitors that had been evaluated throughout the years, including tesolisib, which was reported in the Sandpiper trial at ASCO this past year. And, you know, unfortunately, due to toxicity, they were not well tolerated. So, you know, it's nice that we have a specific target with a specific inhibitor that we can treat these patients. The main side effects that we see with BYL really are hyperglycemia and some gastrointestinal issues and rash. So that's something that we should keep a close eye on, but it's nice to have an inhibitor that specifically targets a mutation that's commonly seen in breast cancer. So I think what we're trying to learn about the PI3K inhibitors is exactly what the best setting is to evaluate these drugs. In this particular study, it was in patients who had endocrine-resistant disease. And also in this study, it primarily did not have patients who previously received a CDK4/6 inhibitor. There was a very small population of about 20 patients or so who had prior CDK4/6 inhibitors that seemed to benefit if they did receive the combination compared to single agent. But we really are waiting to see maybe in a larger series what the response could be with these drugs post CDK4/6 inhibition.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 34th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to hear more about the treatment landscape of hematologic malignancies, consider registering for the April 11th State of the Science Summit in Boston. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on April 16th in Dallas, which will focus on the latest progress made in lung cancer. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.